content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we are still in the chapter on senescence, which is September and October. And the topic we'll start with today is taking the year's inventory. With shears and rake in hand and a clipboard and pen beside me, I tease the garden apart. Cleanup is not all about sanitation, but a bit of a forensic exercise, really a time of sober analysis before all remnants of the growing season that was are erased from memory or masked by a blanket of snow. Normal types may make resolutions at New Year's, but for a gardener, that is no time for such important business. After spring, this is when the garden journal entries should be most frequent, notations of which plants didn't fare well, with suspicions why, and which are too crowded, which look too isolated, add some more of the same, or too overpowering, subtract for the garden's good. If there are pests or disease issues, the coming dormant season is a good time to research tactics for outwitting them, not next summer in the midst of a repeat outbreak. Yes, we must ask, how many times did we run to the garden center to try to shop our way out of an outbreak of something or a weak performance of some plant? Such remedies aren't remedies at all, really, and no substitute for time spent building your soil, as in compost, 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 and practicing vigilant garden hygiene methods. Fall is the best time to evaluate and record your own issues, too. Did you expect too much of yourself by shopping too often? Tip, a small army of plants in nursery pots still sitting in the driveway? Was there simply too much deadheading, watering, weeding to manage? Has the garden gotten too big or too complex in some places? Perhaps such troubles can be alleviated by budgeting for a few hours with a helper or better use of mulch or by a drip irrigation system you could install now, or maybe by changing out the underplantings in some areas to a simpler ground cover palette. Should you find someone to mow next year to free up more time for real gardening? Were there too many tomatoes and cucumbers to eat, or can, or worse, too few? Or not enough basil or dill to accompany them? Or no flowers to cut for indoor use? My resolves by the time my rounds are through will range from test soil in vegetable beds, now not spring is the time, because the labs will be backed up by then, to turn compost an additional time and moisten more often, hoping to heat the pile and reduce weed seeds in finished material, to much loftier matters. I offer this semi-generic list of resolutions for you to cull a few from the customize as you reflect during your own year's review. Mow more creatively. Can you unmow a spot to add diversity or eliminate a lawn area completely? Make better use of self-sowns. with alert editing and moving around of what the garden offers up spontaneously, admittedly sometimes in too great concentration or the wrong spot entirely. Dig up onesies and either eliminate or replicate them. Unless a plant is a stunner that can stand alone, onesies are usually the recipe for a polka dot garden. Repeat successes, the yang to the previous resolution's yin. Add more vines, both annual and perennial. Grow, fill in the blank next year. This is where you get to insert that thing you always want to try but don't. Whether some rarity or such a massive bed full of every last kind of zinnia or sunflower. Rethink and fine-tune vegetable supports, and while you're at it, what else was unsupported where a better job could have been done? Grow more herbs. Compost, better than ever. More mulch, less sprays. Be more ruthless pruner, not a butcher, not extending a firmer hand to that shrub overtaking the path, for instance. There is no cure for too stingy spacing, but certain things can be kept in check with a firmer resolve before it's too late. Remember to go back inside before it's all erased and look out the window where the biggest decision about design begins. And that brings us, I think, here, brings us to the end of that chapter. And so we start a new chapter, which is November and December. And it's called Death and Afterlife. And we start with her paragraphs or couple of pages of her ideas. And she starts with, "Dear friend, love, Margaret. Dear old friend, ouch. Little wonder that you are craving getting all tucked in, my dear, and staying put. Me too, though I have no acute cause like your recent surgery to point the finger at. I can only explain the urgent instinct to hunker like this. I am an animal. The longer I live in Nowheresville, with its intimate window on the natural world, the better I grasp my kindredness with other local species. Yes, I boast a bigger brain, the ability to walk upright, opposable thumbs, though I suppose I'm not alone in that last one, since the local Virginia opossum has them, albeit on his hind feet, and a tail designed to do some grabbing, used for stability while hanging from my suet feeder, gorging each cold evening. Apparently, furlessness and the mechanism to sweat, since cooling down efficiently can boost endurance, are other evolutionary advancements on the human side of the ledger. Right now, though, some fur sounds welcome, and getting overheated inconceivable. Brr. The fur bearers and the rest apparently regard the garden as a wildlife park, and inspired by their example, I'm getting in touch with my animalness. No time of year is it more pronounced than at the seasonal cusps, exaggerated in response to the most extreme pull of natural forces. Like everyone in this habitat, I'm behaving as dwindling day length, temperature, and resources dictate. going about seasonally appropriate business to ensure food, shelter, and safety, or else. Note to self. Check batch of homegrown apples sliced and drying in the oven. Which animal I most like, I am not certain. Perhaps it's some interspecific hybrid of bird, frog, mammal. Some ex-hybridous creature like my hellebores. Once inclined to constant anthropomorphizing in my rural years, I've become more inclined towards seeing the animal in me. Is that sense of identification called zoomorphism? Zoomorphism or what? I can't stop repeating what I know I have quoted to you before. Human behavior wisdom gleaned in a course on bird behavior from Cornell ornithologist Kevin McGowan, thinking of animals like people is misleading and unhelpful and offers no assistance in understanding animal behavior. Thinking of people as animals with the same survival goals can provide profound insights in what we do. And so, like many birds, I am diurnal, punching the mirror image time clock from the nocturnal mice in my wall lately who scuttle around as their shift starts at 4 p.m. or so, and the arriving darkness, and again when settling back into their nests after maybe 12 hours. Each afternoon around 4 o'clock, I'm about done for the day this time of year. At 4-something in the morning, I stir towards starting another. I am resistant, like a woodpecker or turkey, not migrant like a brilliant forest-breeding rose-breasted grosbeaks, scarlet tanagers, or indigo buntings, which visit in the milder months. I never wander far from where I nest. I do not scatter hoard my store of food for the duration, placing the equivalents of an acorn here and another there and another somewhere else, the way a squirrel does, or a tufted titmouse or blue jay with their sunflower seeds tucked under bits of bark or siding. I spent the fall larder hoarding instead, like the mice or adult eastern chipmunks, stashing all my provisions in one central pantry. Back and forth, load after load. Exciting! A bobcat lately is paying regular visits. The handsome feline is by nature solitary. I am no pack animal either, as you well know. He is a sometime hoarder. If a deer is scored in winter, such a cache lasts weeks. A lucky thing when snow is deep and hunting rodents or rabbits challenging. I am no carnivore, but am guarding 3 freezers stocked with what the garden offered. Brewed into soups and stews and sauces, jewel-colored bricks of suspended animation substances. A disappointing divergence. Nobody out there seems to reciprocate the delight I get from their presence, appearing either indifferent or occasionally disturbed by mine. I find my outdoor neighbors endlessly fascinating, even to acrobatic black morph individuals of the eastern gray squirrel who have made the garden home. Perhaps they don't have a Peterson Field Guide to Eastern Humans to read up on all my most riveting aspects the way I have my reference books depicting each of theirs. Now what? You ask in your recent letter, here there is still the last yard cleanup to complete. I know, but the leaves, they held on and on this fall, lacking the proper weather triggers to the abscissian layer that say, let go. And even now, keep descending, so onward I do rake. There are many apples to be processed into sauce, the water gardens to winterize, and then there is surrender to a sober rhythm. Then we are resting, but not completely down for the count. I liked how you put it. Lying fallow is different from doing nothing. But just some abandoned or neglected bed or field, a fallow one is a deliberate stage in a scheme of successful crop rotation, perhaps sown with green manure a while so that it may be more bountiful at another time. It may look like nothing is happening, but good soil health is being intentionally cultivated. What's going on here, you ask? Everything, if all unseen. We are not alone in our hunkering instinct, nor is there total stillness even on the quietest approaching days. I think of the female black bear who though still in hibernation, rouses just after the new year to give birth to her young, then naps again while they take sustenance from their sleepy mother. I think of the tadpoles in my garden ponds, waiting for their chance to move on up. Apparently, the green frog species will wait longer than a year if conditions so require, holding on, half-baked, even through a hard winter, before letting go of their heavy, unneeded, but familiar tails. Metamorphosis is no instant karma, baby. We all shine on. I think of the mated female bumblebees, the only members of last season's colonies who even survive winter. Bumblebees, like annual plants, do everything by the end of summer and then die out. All the males and workers, and even the founding queen of the colony, gone. At our senescent life stage, we're not fecund like they are, or like those mama bears, but we are full in our own ways, no? Please say yes. In March, weather willing, I'll see those gravid female bees hovering low among the earliest flowers, seeking nectar for themselves and pollen too. It is only then, not in fall, that the queen-to-be provisions a nest by stashing the pollen. Unlike honeybees, who rely on honey inside the hive all winter, bumblebees have no need to store resources because they're hibernating or already gone on to their reward, having lived a good, short life. Me? I'm hungry all the time. I told a doctor friend last winter when the deep freeze descended, my tone implying it was a symptom of something amiss, I can't stop eating. Have you watched the squirrels and birds at their feeders lately? He said, rhetorically, fully aware that I do just that nonstop, between trips in search of yet another snack, and then back under the duvet to study the latest catalogs. And then it says, love, Margaret. And that's the end of her introduction to this chapter. So we will begin the first topic of this chapter, and it's the asset of bark. In 1947, article, Woody Plants with Interesting Bark in Winter, in Arnoldia, the Bulletin of the Arnold Arboretum, stated the case simply. The more color in the winter landscape, the more interesting the garden, wrote the great plantsman Donald Wyman, whose Wyman's Garden Encyclopedia was for many years my most used volume. From a winter walk on the Arboretum grounds, Wyman listed many dozens of plants with twigs of red, gray, yellow, green, or white, or colorful trunks or branches, and others that patterned so or texturally appealing bark. Too often, though, we seem not to notice. Maybe that's because it's always right in front of us, 365 days a year on every tree and shrub. Perhaps we just take bark for granted instead of seeking it out specifically. As we shop for plants, distracted in the warmer months by flowers and leaves. The various white-skinned birches, so often illustrated against a snowy backdrop as the stuff of Christmas cards, are not the only example. The native river birch, Betula nigra, has better resistance to birch borer and other insect pests, and peeling bark of various pinkish salmon to reddish brown shades. The compact little king is ideal for a home garden at under 15 feet. Nuthatches, brown creepers, and oh, so many squirrels share my gratitude towards whomever planted the now towering triple-trunked arborvita of some kind perhaps a century ago just beyond the kitchen door with its peeling cinnamon bark. Exfoliating bark that lets go in patches with age to reveal a camouflage pattern is an enduring trait of Japanese Dewartia. And the Kusa dogwood, another Asian import. With not just the bark to recommend them, but also vivid fall foliage and showy flowers, this Stewartia in July, when they are so unexpected, I am happy to greet these trees every day. In the case of the Kusa, there is even fruit, like giant raspberries, that every chipmunk in the county seems to know about by now. The lacebark pine has vivid camouflage pattern bark, but members of the ample local population of yellow-bellied sapsuckers did mine in with incessant drilling of sapwells. Thin-skinned trees like that and the magnolias may have smooth, handsome gray bark, are targets here for that woodpecker, and even if the tree survive, it defeats the purpose to have it gritted out in pockmarks. I have to stifle my anger because it's all part of a bigger co-voluntarily plan, apparently. Ruby-throated hummingbirds east of the Mississippi find sustenance at the sapwells when few flowers are blooming at spring migration time. With all such trees, choose the individual you adopt carefully for its structure, since good bark and a good silhouette are the most powerful combination of all in the winter landscape. I am inclined toward multi-stemmed specimens that branch low rather than waiting till a substantial distance up the trunk to begin breaking. A number of maples promise color and texture in the winter garden, including the paper bark maple from China with cinnamon-colored bark that exfoliates. Among so-called Japanese maples is the coral bark maple, startling against the winter sky. There are Japanese maples with gold winter bark, and also green, which remind me of the native moosewood, with its green trunk striped in white that makes up a component of the woodland edge encircling my garden. Such chlorophyll-containing bark can even trap light energy and conduct photosynthesis, including in winter. So it's not just window dressing. Generally, younger wood will have the best color in all of these, as with blueberries and even some roses and the shrubby twig willows and dogwoods that I enjoy so much. I placed a red twig dogwood sunshine with gold foliage in season just beyond the window through which I glimpse my first bit of garden when I come downstairs each morning. A true 365-day garden plant and tolerant of damp soils, it is a massive gold spring into fall and then a vivid arrangement of bright red stems the rest of the year. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you'd enjoyed it. I'm Anadine Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And I hope you join us for our next podcast, which will continue